to the third talk in a seven-talk series on fear in its various forms and disguises that it takes. As a preamble to this particular talk on the fear of being meaningless, I'd just like to say that what I'm trying to do is, as we begin to explore the nature of fear and to see how it gets warped and distorted into different patterns within us, different ways that we resist small and closeted areas of ourself, we must remember, sort of fundamentally, that fear in its essence is an untruth. That it's a very well thought out lie. Very convincing. But unless we test it, unless we're willing to put ourselves forward and to test the theory of fear, the conjecture, the convincing quality of it, we stay within its limitation. And so we can talk about this for these 14 weeks, but it does require us to have certain resources that we're willing to say, okay, let me just see this. Let me just start experiencing whether this is true or not. And again, as we pierce the veil of its untruth again and again and again, when we hear its language, it's like somebody who lies to you all the time. Maybe the first or second or third or fourth or maybe even the tenth time you'll believe that person, but in a waning quality. Suddenly, the person will tell you something and you'll recognize the voice and it just doesn't hold true any longer. So too the voice of fear, the physical voice of fear, the contractibility, the sense of pervasive anxiety, the fast beating heart, the quickened pulse, and perhaps perspiration associated with that, whatever the physiological responses to fear may be, are very convincing that we should be in flight. That's what the message of fear is. We should be in flight. And those are the messages, those are the biological messages of flight, which work very well when a lion was running after us. It doesn't work so well when we've incorporated the fears into a psychological way of being. That's when they need to be tested. And that's when they falter in their language and tone. And so just because we're feeling these physiological changes that have accompanied fear since time immemorial, it doesn't mean that they need to lead to the next flight, the next step, which is to leave the scene, to flee. We can use those as, we can turn it back in on itself and start using it as cues for the lie. You see what I'm saying? So, okay, so fear's coming now. All right, so I'm prepared for the lie. What lie are you giving me today? What lie is up front today? So I want to make sure that we understand that, because we're going to take each one of these manifestations of fear far too seriously. As there's something wrong with me, as we begin to explore them, and every one of us can find the core of our being ensconced with fear. I mean, that's what holds us together as me and you. So we're going to, at some point, as we delve into our psyche from our meditative journey, we're going to run into this fears again and again. And what can happen is, instead of plunging down through the untruth, we follow the layer of its message. And then just we follow it horizontally forever, trying to work with the fear that we have of big crowds. And so you'll work on the object of fear, desensitizing yourself by first hanging out with one person, and then two people, and then five people, and then 10 people, and then coming to Sims. And you may well do that. It's a perfectly legitimate way to end the object of fear, but it does nothing to fear itself, except show you its lie in that case. But what about all the other cases that it has? I mean, it's endless in its variety. So fear, in its essence, is what we're looking at here. Lest we're just taking apart some of the different ways it expresses itself and looking. So that's important. So the journey tonight, as I was mentioning to some of you, I came upon the 5 fears in Buddhist literature, and I somehow made them into 7. Well, this particular fear was the fear of the loss of livelihood or the loss of reputation. So that's the way it was stated in the text. So I thought, okay, what does it mean to lose our livelihood besides just the financial insecurity and reputation? Without the sense of image, without when our image gets stripped away, if suddenly we're without the dependency of a particular form and expression of our image, we can get thrown back into a deeper level of fear. So I think underlying the fear of loss of a vocation or a loss of reputation is the fear of being meaningless, of having no meaning. It's an interesting one, really. I mean, we journey through our lives thinking that the great revelations will come, that somehow there'll be a thunderous struck, you know, a lightning bolt, which will reveal why it is that we're alive. And as Virginia Woolf said, mostly we just see little matches in the dark. For most of us, the great revelation doesn't come. And it's interesting because we keep looking for it. We keep working in a kind of a psychic way, expecting, the myth to pay off, don't we? As Mary Oliver said in one of her poems, "Are you breathing just a little and calling it a life?" Are you breathing just a little and calling it a life? And sometimes we're thrown back into a kind of despair. Are we wasting our times here? Do you ever wake up and think, you know, suddenly you're 40 or 50? Or even 20. I had my most devastating birthday at 25. Right before I got involved in the Dharma, and I think it was a despair of thinking that at 25 I should be somewhere. There should be something that has been occurring and has occurred that hadn't occurred. And I felt like a failure. And I remember in the third grade, it's amazing how teachers, grade school teachers, can have such an imprintable quality on our psyche. But I had a third grade teacher that I did something very early in the year, and she didn't like me. And so she had, anyway, it was a very difficult year for me. And she kept essentially saying to me that, I was never going to make anything of my life. And so when I was 25, I heard her voice again and again, it coming back in, so when is it going to happen? Maybe she was right. You see, maybe she was right. What is that? Where does that when somebody says something vicious like that, where does it strike home? Because for us to assume the correctness of that statement, it has to strike home. There has to be a pain that we carry in which that is the place that it strikes. See, when you get interested in yourself, you'll get interested in the pain you carry. And no longer will the pain we carry be a constant reminder of our deficiency, and we will then overcompensate for that deficiency by doing all kinds of acting out. But rather, at some point, the pain we carry becomes the very life. It's the very resuscitation of our life. We realize that if we pass up this opportunity to understand this pain, that we are just reinforcing our own death in some ways. And so a student of the Dharma looks for those opportunities to understand their pain, his or her pain. And certainly the pain of despair. Now, despair can lead in two different tracks. There is the despair of a sense of unworthiness, that we've lived so long feeling inadequate, that there's the despair of life from that view through the glasses of inadequacy that makes it difficult to even try to do the next thing. And because meaning is directly correlated to our sense of self-worth, the greater the sense of self-worth, the greater we give life meaning. If you feel good about yourself, then usually there is a corresponding, almost always, a corresponding sense of excitement about life and energetic relationship with it. But despairing, most of us carry an ongoing history of despair, which sometimes makes it very difficult to get out of bed. It's a neurotic belief in our own sense of worthlessness, really. I mean, that's a little strong, but it's fairly accurate. Now, that's one type of despair. Another type of despair, and these two types of despair are can sometimes overlap, but another type of despair is when you look out at what everyone is doing and you see that what they're doing is essentially meaningless. Now, you can be feeling a lot of self-worth or none, but you can look out and you can say, now what is everybody moving in that direction for, and why is everybody trying to get more of this, and there can be a discernment that leads to a kind of despair of what life is offering that is not colored by our sense of inadequacy. Do you see how those two can be very different? Now, that second type of despair is actually understanding. And it is the basis on which most spiritual journeys begin. And it's an important aspect of most people's practice. It is the beginning of what is called the dark night of the soul, in the sense that life isn't working for you anymore. It's supposed to work. We were promised that it was going to work. The American way, and you know, Doesn't get any better than this. And yet it doesn't work. It doesn't feel satisfying. It doesn't feel meaningful. Meaningful, really. More than satisfying, it's meaningful. It doesn't resonate with something deep in us. And there's something deep in us. I like that poem I read about, you know, under all of this, the tender heart throbs. You see? Because that's what's waiting to be touched. That's what, and our culture doesn't provide a measuring stick for that. It doesn't offer incentives in that direction. It offers incentives in the direction of despair. So there's going to be inevitably a dark night when the payoffs aren't meaningful and aren't valid for us anymore. We may have to have gone through a lot of payoffs, a lot of self-punishment. How come there, you know, I remember when I was in college, very young, and I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, and I said, you know, I don't know what it means to be happy. It wasn't because I hadn't experienced happiness. It was because how people were directing their lives seemed meaningless, even at that age. What does it mean to be happy? To be able to ask these questions. You see, mostly we run from these questions. These questions scare us because they shake everything up. We have to be willing to face the inevitable conclusion of those questions that the way we have been spending and generating energy in this life has been meaningless. And most of us don't want, that's too dismissive, too negating of my whole 40, 50, 60 years of living. I'll just keep going, and then hopefully either I'll find that it was really behind door 3 and I've just been checking out the first 2. Or I'll die, and then, you know, it'll wipe the problem away. I find it interesting. You can find out what's your current area of meaning or interest by the first questions that come out of your mouth when you meet somebody new. What work do you do? Right? If you're in Texas, which is where I lived for a while, it's what church do you go to? That's what's most meaningful. That's the first thing that in Central Texas they ask. In some countries, it's how many children do you have, or what's your political persuasion, or whatever. It's interesting, though, what if we didn't ask that question? What if you just don't ask that one? Get to know a person free of your induced meaning. See, because you're measuring how meaningful they are by their response to your meaningful question. And missing the person in between. And this fear, you see, okay, so when I'm asking a question, what is meaningful? I have to be willing to feel meaningless, inadequate. Because maybe it's me that's not making this thing work. Maybe it's not out there that it's not working, because maybe there is something out there that I just haven't discovered, but maybe it's the fact that I'm inadequate and can't access the skills or accomplishments or energy or intellect or whatever to make it work. I mean, that's a logical possibility, isn't it? Maybe it's your fault this thing isn't working. And what does that do? Where does that leave us to ask that question? I'm back on my feelings of insufficiency. I don't want to go there. So I'll just keep trying to make it work. And I'll pretend that it is working. I'll smile. And I'll stay busy. Busyness is often a sign that something isn't working. And you're desperately trying to make it. I look at the amount of technological access we have, the busyness, the phone calls, the computer emails, the number of messages that validate. Please validate me. Phone ring. Give me how many times a day do we check email? When the mailman comes, validate me. Somebody has some, you see? Our busyness. Our busyness. And what makes us feel, what momentarily gives us relief from that sense of inadequacy and gives us some sense of meaning is success, mostly. I'm successful. Oh, okay, I'm successful. And as long as we can maintain success, which isn't long for most of us, we can feel that life is really working for us. It's interesting, failure and success both confirm our existence. But failure confirms that you're wasting your existence. And success confirms that your existence is meaningful. But both confirm existence, that you're somebody. You have a place. Even if it's a failed place, you have a place. I remember I worked in my graduate years in a it was a maximum security for delinquent children who were they were young teens and were very, I mean, they were like murderers and rapists, and one kid had killed both his parents, and I mean it was just, and they used to set up the staff, myself included, so that they would fail, so that we would react to them as society had reacted to them, everybody had. And it was so hard not to, because they knew they were so accomplished in the way that they had learned to invoke failure, the response to failure. And you would find yourself wanting to kill this kid, and you realize that he had set me up to feel just that. And so we can, and that was his place. He knew when I acted like that to him, that he was in his place. He belonged. He was, that was his existence. That was what he knew. And he felt very comfortable in that place. And so failure can be a place, because what we want, even more than we want meaning, a positive meaning, is a sense of belonging. A sense of confirmation. This is my place. And so many of us have formed our sense of belonging around our sense of inadequacy, which inevitably leads to failure. We're not even trying. God, I work with the beginning classes, and I can look out often and feel resonance of whether, you know, there's this kind of an inherent set of failure. I can't do this. You know, after about the second or maybe into the third week, when they come back, I can look in the faces and I know, you know, it's how hard it is. And it's like, I can't do this. And they've confirmed their place, their sense of belonging. So we have to be aware of that. Do you want to stay that way? Do we want to just stay there? You see, everything that's familiar, I don't care if it's a positive mood or a negative mood, if it's lived in sufficient time, if you spend enough time with it, it becomes an identity, an image. Anger, fear. And then life begins to take on that resonance. Hopefully what we're doing here is meeting together to really be willing to challenge some of this complacency. I don't know whether you are or not, but that's what the purpose of SIMS is. So how do we compensate for the fear of being insignificant? Through the great American way, which is production. The more we produce, the more sense of success we have, the less we can hold off our sense of inadequacy, and the more we can feel meaningful. Production. This whole country is about production. I am what I produce. And that's the busyness, you know. I don't know if it's the highest productivity in the world, but pretty close. Other people are willing to take leisure. But for us to take leisure throws us back on our worst fears. We have to be alone with your mind. Do you ever notice that a vacation is nothing more than who you are all day long? You've just taken it to a forest or a beach and just as miserable. You always think vacation will get you out of your misery. It doesn't. It doesn't get you out of your misery at all. Puts you right in there, except it doesn't give you the busyness to... And this doing mentality is very much a part of our practice histories, isn't it? We carry that into our practice. And yet the essence of meditation is non-doing. The essence of meditation is seeing these things, is being willing to see them, which requires not acting them out. If you're acting them out, you're not going to see them. You're just acting them out. You're just a puppet to them. The pattern is behind us, and we are playing it out. The hand is in us, and we're playing the puppet. You take the doing out, the puppet falls flat. Now, okay, let me look at this thing. That's the point of meditation, is to see what drives us, to see what's behind us, unconscious, and to bring it into conscious attention. But many of us, because we feel that there is such a deep level of meaningless in us, try to find and establish some sense of meaning in our meditation. So we pursue things which will give us a greater sense of image, which is more doing. Still driven, we still can be driven by the pain. We're just trying to compensate now by more subtle forms of producing subtle mind states or whatever. It's really quite remarkable that any of us get through this. Because it's hard. It's so hard. The path is so strewn, if that's a word, with pitfalls. And I don't know, at some point it requires the inevitable bottoming out. You know, I don't care now. Let me look at this, my sense of meaninglessness. And it may be that I will just be covered in despair. The conclusion will be, I am meaningless, life is meaningless, I'll go eat worms. You see, but it's that resolution of heart that says, even if I prove to be nothing, which is in fact the truth, but we don't think of nothing as being that nothing. We think of nothing as being despairing nothing, right? But it's the truth that we are nothing. And so behind us, way back in there somewhere, is the acknowledgement that we are nothing. We just cover that nothing over with despair and say, I'm not going there. That's miserable. That's empty. A whole nothing. I mean, what good is it? So we continue to do. And then we have to ask ourselves from time to time, okay, let me look at life here. Let me look at life the way it is and see what is meaningful. And see whether it really does invite truth, invite resonance of the deepest part of me. And so we start putting the things that we have thought to be meaningful and look at them. And all the material world, all the products, all the money, all the images, we have to put up right in front of our eye. Is this what I want my life to be about? Is this it? Now, I'll give you a shortcut so that you don't have to, okay, how about this, and how about this, and how, because it's endless, right? Put everything you think is meaningful in your left hand and put death in your right hand and put them side by side. Because if something is going to be truly meaningful, it has to withstand the right hand. Because if it's going to be taken away from me, if that's going to be extracted from me, if it's going to be ripped away, then how meaningful can it be? Success. Whoa. Okay, here's one. My children. You see, it doesn't get funny. It gets serious. Because all relationships have to end in separation. Have to. Hopefully you'll die before your children, but that's not a given. It doesn't mean that you aren't the best parent, that you don't care about your child. It doesn't mean a lack of caring when you discover that death will take it away. It doesn't mean that. It means that you don't rest your whole life upon it. That's not the sum total of the worth of your life. That there's something deeper. There has to be something deeper than your children, than success, than material possessions, than every display of life as we know it externally. Every display, put it next, right there. And it can't withstand it. So now, the meditator, the spiritual journeyer, will say, okay. All right, I can start orienting myself. You see, there's an extraction of value, of worth, from things. This is the spiritual journey. Do not put up where your treasures, where rust doth corrupt or thieves let in. Christ is saying the same thing. Because it's going to die. So rust doth corrupt. Or it can be taken from us. You don't put up your... Look at the right hand. Don't just give yourself over as if that were some reason for being alive, because it can't be. So now it's getting interesting. So then the meditator, the Dharma student, says, okay, it's about heart. Heart. Right? Being kind. Caring. And so I need to be more caring. And more kind. And more loving. Okay. Now we're back into the production phase again. We're producing. We're staying busy. And however caring we are, we're not as caring as we could be if we just cared more. And we look at Mother Teresa and say, well, that's it. I failed. And we're just, right? Because we're not there yet. We're on the right path. It's a deeper and richer and more spiritual step than casting our worth into the inevitable death cycles. But we're not there yet. And that's no, I don't want to just bypass that and dismiss it, because it's valuable. It's valuable to the heart's in there. It's closer to the surface, you might say. It can feel its risen. Okay, life, you know, it's about the relationship I have with life, not holding on to the things of life. Very important. We just have to be very careful what we mean by the relationship of life. It is about the relationship of life. But not in terms of producing. It's in terms of connecting. Connecting is not producing. When we're producing, we aren't totally connected because we're not kind enough yet. When we're kind enough, then we can connect. But I haven't, as long as we're in the production phase, connection will be postponed until there is more production in that particular quality that I want. Then I can connect. You see that? So meaningful, what is meaningful to me, has yet to take full fruit, yet to fully blossom. I'm not loving enough. I'm not good enough. Enough, enough, enough. Enough! Enough of enough. And then the meditator, the journeyer, we're journeying together. We're exploring together. That's what we're doing. We're exploring together. Says, where is full arrival? Say, enough production. I'm still not completely satisfied. It's always future. I can't. What if I just stopped? No more production. What if I just stopped? If it's not here, if it's not meaningful here, where is it going to be? If it's not meaningful now, when is it going to be? If it's not meaningful here with me, whom is it going to be with? Meaningful with? If not me, then whom? If not now, then when? If not here, then where? Enough. That's it. It's got to be now or never. That's it. It's got to be now or never. So, but I don't feel, Mother Teresa had a, and then we're just thrown back. Despair starts coming up, because when you're not busy producing, the thing that has created the action away from the busyness, which has been the ingredient to get me away from the despair, when I'm not being busy, the despair comes back. Oh, is this what it means to stop? Is being despairing? Oh, No. We stop with the despair. It doesn't mean that you negate the despair. You don't move with it. You don't let it set you off into more production. You say, that's it. It's despairing. I can feel this. And the whole thing turns from a continuum of more is not enough to this is sufficient. Despair is sufficient. Why not? Why not? Why can't it be sufficient? Why can't it? Who said it couldn't? But what about meaning? Okay, I have to... See, this is the maxim. We have to dispel every meaningful thing to come to that which is truly meaningful. It's over there. It's there. It's over there. It's further. It's got to be in the future. It's next door. It's in the neighbors. No. No. Cross them off. Check them off. Nope. 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 Death will do it for you. Just wave the right hand. Now. Everything is meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Despair, oh! Suddenly, of course. When the moment is lived, everything is meaningful. That question doesn't even arise. What's meaningful? It doesn't even come up. It doesn't even enter the consciousness. What is meaningful? When the consciousness has stopped. It doesn't even arise. Because how would anyone say that it... How could it not be? The music is not a disturbance. It's a part of the display. The wondrous display. And then the question of what is meaningful is truly lived, is truly lived and not pondered over. Can we sit for a minute or two?